This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had to be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and I have for you another fine, carefully brewed cup of night transmissions. We're going to start off with something that's a little unusual for this show that appeared on July the 3rd of 1944, called It Happened Tomorrow. One of the things that's a little different about it is that it's a fantasy. Into a lot of fantasies, but it's from Lux Radio Theater. Not a radio program I use a whole lot, not because there's anything wrong with it. Lux Radio Theater was an anthology that ran on NBC's Blue Network in 1934 and 1935, and then moved over to CBS for the next 20 years. This program is high on anyone's list of genuine radio class. Beginning as a program of adaptations of radio stage productions, the series would quite quickly add movies to its fare. The adaptations are hour-long productions and were recorded live before audiences, first in New York and then moving to Hollywood. It was produced and hosted by the film legend Cecil B. DeMille. I suppose because of the prestige that the program had developed, it was able to feature many of the most famous stage and movie actors of the time. Fairly often actually managing to get the original performers to reprise their role on the radio show. This may also have something to do with the fact that the Lux Radio Theater paid uncommonly well, usually $5,000 per performance. And you should remember that this is when $5,000 was real money. Not that it isn't real money now. I mean, $5,000 will buy a lot of hot dogs.
Lux presents Hollywood. The Lux Radio Theater brings you Don Ameche and Ann Baxter in It Happened Tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille.
Greetings from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. Since our remote ancestors lived in caves and fought their wars with clubs, men have wanted to know the true story of the future. Some wanted this knowledge only to grow rich, others to grow famous, and perhaps a few to help their fellow men. But since the beginning of time, all of our yesterdays lead only toward tomorrow. And this week, our play is René Clair's delightful and exciting picture, It Happened Tomorrow. Arnold Pressburger produced the picture, and Don Ameche and Ann Baxter starred in it for us tonight. It Happened Tomorrow is the drama of one man who begs for a chance to see tomorrow's newspaper today, and gets that chance. Many strange and wonderful adventures come to him, and the greatest of them all is meeting a very beautiful girl. But after you hear this story, I wonder if you'll ever again want to see tomorrow's newspaper today. In crossing the country last week, I met still more of our audience face to face. And when that happens, I always discover again how strong the loyalty is that holds you to this theater and to the product behind it, Lux Flakes. I remember one person in particular. She told me right away that she was a grandmother. And then I learned how she was doing her bit for the war. She had made it possible for her daughter to take a job in a war plant by looking after the daughter's baby and the rather extensive laundry that always goes with the young of the human species. Grandmother made just one proviso. For the sake of her hands, the daughter was to provide Lux Flakes. Consequently, I feel sure that that baby is still in very lovely hands. And now, for the last time this season, the curtain goes up on the opening of our play. Act One of It Happened Tomorrow, starring Donna Meachie as Larry and Ann Baxter as Sylvia. It's an event that has never happened before and will never happen again. The Stevens' golden wedding anniversary. Children, grandchildren, even great-grandchildren have thronged to the Stevens' home for the happy occasion. Yes, every member of the family is present. Everyone except the two people responsible. They're still upstairs observing 50 years of wedded bliss, arguing over a manuscript.
But you can't do it. I simply forbid it.
For 50 years you've kept me from publishing this.
Thank goodness I have.
But why? Why?
Because it happens that I love you.
Oh. Well.
And I won't have you laughed at.
But at least let me read it to my family. They'll never believe it unless they hear it from me.
I was in on most of it and I still don't believe it.
Well, you just don't believe in miracles.
Nobody believes in miracles anymore.
I do.
And so do I, my dear.
Oh, Sylvia, you're wonderful. I'm wonderful, too. Hmm?
You must be. You put up with me for a long, long time.
Oh, darling, how can I ever thank you?
Well, one way would be by forgetting all about that story and coming downstairs with me now.
Yes, yes. Here, you can put it away.
That's better.
I just wanted to read it to them, and then they could judge what happened for themselves.
But if they didn't believe it, Larry, if they said that you were an old man and foolish.
Yes, I am an old man, but I was young then, wasn't I? When it all started to happen? 1896. I guess I've been a reporter on the evening news for almost a year.
And I never even knew you existed.
But you did that night, didn't you? Thanks to William Jennings Bryan running for president. Andy and I had gone back to the office to write up a speech. Just the two of us were there. An old Pop Benson.
Files, boys?
Yeah, thanks, Pop. Didn't mean to leave them so messed up.
That's all right. Just find yourself another seat.
What?
Larry, you're sitting on one of my file albums, right in the middle of 1862.
Oh, sorry, Pop, sorry.
I've been keeping these files just so for 42 years, and you sit on them.
What's the difference, Pop? There's nothing deader than yesterday's news.
You don't have imagination, Andy. News is what happens, whether it happened 50 years ago or tomorrow.
You mean will happen tomorrow?
Tomorrow's just an illusion. Look, see this album?
Yeah, sure. It's the file for, what's that, March 1875.
That's right. And this file here, that's for this year, 1896. Well, supposing we're all living in 1875 and I should walk in with the 1896 file. I could tell you everything that would happen, couldn't I?
Just give me the one for next year, Pop, and you can name your own price.
Every year's there, Andy, right on those shelves where I keep my file albums. We may not see them, but they're there, all right. The whole future's there.
Ah, what if we could see into the future? Really see it? Yeah, just one day in the future. That's what I'd like, Pop. Tomorrow's newspaper. How much?
No, no, Larry. Don't ask for a thing like that.
Well, that ought to be a cinch for you, Pop. Come on, come on. Let's have it.
I wish I could give it to you, Larry. Then you'd learn it's no good to know the future.
Oh, if I knew where I could get tomorrow's newspaper, I'd give 5 years of my life for it.
You would, huh? But how do you know you've got 5 years?
Go ahead and answer that one, Larry.
I guess you got me, Pop.
Well, there's one thing I can guarantee will happen 5 minutes from now.
What's that?
You and I are going to be mighty thirsty. Come on, let's go. We can have a beer on Park Street.
Yeah, how about it, Pop?
No, thanks. Got a few things to get in order here. Say, I passed that cafe on the way to work. Got some new entertainment there. Mind readers, the poster says Lombardi and Sylvia. Maybe they could tell you the future.
Well, good night, Pop.
A mighty pretty looking girl in that act. At least she was on the posters.
Yeah, they always are, Pop, on the posters. But I can tell you right now, she's full, fat, and 40.
Good night, boys. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you have just seen, I have just placed Sylvia in a trance. Only my voice, the voice of Lombardi, can reach her. I will require the presence of a member of the audience here on the stage. Will someone volunteer? Any member of the audience? Ah, that gentleman there.
Well, look, you can stay here all night if you want to, Larry. I'm going home.
Look at her. Just look at
her. I've been looking at her. She's beautiful and I'm tired. Good night.
Good night, Sylvia.
Oh, good night. And just remember, 8 o'clock in the morning.
An angel. She's an angel.
And if you're late, you'll be flapping your wings, too. Well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Now, if you will stand here, my friend, and please to tell us, what is the number in the case of your watch? The number, please.
Well, I don't know.
Oh, you do not know? Good. Now, perhaps Sylvia can tell you the number. Observe, she is on the other side of the stage. Sylvia, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
The gentleman holds a watch, Sylvia. I want to know the number on the case.
I will try. I will try. 279. Oh, I can't. I can't.
Sylvia, I compel you.
Oh, weak. I feel so weak.
Tell me the number.
279-354.
279-354. Open the case, my friend. And now, sir, please, to verify Sylvia's statement.
279-354. Why, it's amazing, incredible.
Thank you very much. Now, does the audience have any questions? Any questions they would like Sylvia to answer? Quickly, please, quickly.
Professor?
The young man, you have a question.
Well, it concerns the young lady.
Of course, naturally. And you wish to know, is she going to marry you? Is that it?
Well, all I want to know is if she will have lunch with me tomorrow.
Sylvia, the senor wishes to know, will the girl he loves have lunch with him tomorrow?
Yes, she will.
Well, thank you, but I'd like to know where.
That you will have to arrange with her.
Well, that's what I'd like to do, but she can't hear me. She's in a trance.
I'm sorry, my friend. Lombardi has put Sylvia's mind to sleep, and Lombardi is not certain when it will awaken. In the meantime, Sylvia is unable to accept any social engagements. Now, who else has a question, please?
I'd like to know your Tommy Sylvia.
One at a time, please. One at a time. You, Signorina, you want to know where to look for the ring you lost. Sylvia, the Signorina wishes to know.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Sylvia. See you tomorrow.
Good night. Oh, cabbie. North Elm Street, please. 140
Hello.
North.
Remember me?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Oh, but we were speaking just a little while ago. You answered my question.
Oh, a customer.
Yeah, something like that.
Then you must have seen that I was in a trance, asleep. Besides, you were much too forward.
Look, may I take you home? Cabbie's waiting.
So I noticed. Good night.
Oh, can I ride with you?
Of course not. Driver 140 North Elm Street.
Yes, ma'am.
But if you go off in the cab, what'll I do?
I haven't the slightest idea. But if my uncle should find
uncle?
You here, Professor Lombardi.
Oh.
He'd very likely punch you in the nose. So go home.
Yes, I think you're right. All right, driver. And go slow.
Hi up there.
Now, you listen to me. Who hired this cab?
I did. But waiting half an hour for you.
Oh, I see. Then you can let me out right here.
Oh, but why? You're perfectly safe. You just sit in that corner and I'll stay way over here in this corner. Of course, if we should hit some bumps, that won't be my fault.
Now, why did you have to slap my face?
You forgot. I'm a mind reader.
Oh, all right. I promise I won't even think of kissing you.
You'd better not, and I'd much prefer the conversation ended right now.
No, not until I know whether your prediction is right or not.
What prediction?
The signor wishes to know will the girl he loves have lunch with him tomorrow. Remember?
I never remember anything I say in a trance.
But your answer was that she will.
Oh, that's fine. I hope you have a wonderful time.
Oh, I'm sure we will. You know where the evening news office is?
Certainly.
I'll be waiting there for you. 1 o'clock tomorrow.
What?
And the name is Stevens, Lawrence Stevens. Just ask for Larry.
Driver, stop this cab at once.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm getting out.
Oh, I wouldn't think of it. I'll get out.
It's about time.
Well, look, we're right in front of the office. See, the evening news. 1 o'clock tomorrow.
If you don't eat lunch until you see me, you're going to starve to death.
Are you sure you have the name? Larry Stevens. And good night.
Good night. And thank you.
Me.
Larry.
Pop, is that you?
Larry.
Pop, where are you? Oh, I guess I couldn't see in the dark.
I've been waiting for you, Larry.
You've been waiting? You've been working all this time?
Oh, no. Locked up the office some time ago.
Oh, but it's late. What are you doing around here this time of night?
I wanted to see you, Larry. I've got something for you.
What's that?
This, Larry. Here.
What's the paper? The evening news.
That's right.
But I read it. I read it when it came out this afternoon.
Maybe not.
Well, now, Pop, you've been getting yourself a snootful.
No, I wouldn't do a thing like that. Good night, Larry.
Wait a minute. I'll take you home.
No, thanks, my boy. We go different ways. Put the paper in your coat pocket, Larry. That's it. Don't lose it.
Huh? Pop, I don't...
In your pocket, Larry. Good night.
Good night, Pop.
Come on in, Larry. You want to see the breakfast menu?
No, just the usual, Lily.
Hello, Larry.
Well, Joe, how are you? Come on, sit down.
Thanks. Just dropped in for a cup of coffee. Sure is cold out.
Yeah, great weather for me. How goes it, Joe?
Oh, not so good. Still looking for a job. Yeah. Say, do you mind if I look at the want ads in your paper?
I'm sorry, I haven't got a paper.
Sure you have. They're in your coat pocket.
What are you... Oh, yeah, I forgot. Here, it's last night's evening news.
That won't matter. Just the want ads I'm after.
Mm.
Hey, this ain't last night's paper, Larry. It's today's.
Well, it can't be, Joe. News doesn't go to press until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's last night's.
Yeah, but what day is today?
It's Wednesday.
But this says Wednesday.
Well, now, Joe, it can't say Wednesday.
Now, look.
Wednesday. Hey, Lil, what day is today?
It's Wednesday.
And look what it says here, Larry. Snow. It didn't snow yesterday, did it?
Of course not. Let me see this.
There. Right next to this article about the Opera House holdup.
Bandits steal cash at Opera House while Paderewski plays.
See? It says unseasonable snowfall. A flurry of snow descended on the city at 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, it's Wednesday. All day. And what a day. Snow in May.
Huh?
Well, look outside there. It's snowing.
Yeah, it's snowing.
8 o'clock in the morning. And it is 8 o'clock. Exactly 8 o'clock.
Say, here's an ad that looks pretty good, Larry. They need a waiter at the Excelsior restaurant. Why, that's this place. This here's the Excelsior restaurant.
What are you talking about? We don't need any waiter.
But it says so in the paper. Help wanted. Waiter, Excelsior restaurant.
Well, I can't help what it says. It's a mistake. We don't need any.
Then why waste people's time putting ads in the...
You crazy fool! You get out of here! That's the last time you'll break any of my dishes. Now get out.
Ah, Mike, have a heart.
I have a heart, but I have no more dishes. You're fired. Lily.
Yes, Mike?
Take us some money and go down to the newspaper. Put in, we want a waiter right away. Now, what do you look so crazy for?
In the morning paper?
No, right away. Put in the evening news. Hello, Larry.
Hello, Mike.
Well, what's the matter? You sick too? You and Lily. What for you looking so funny at me, huh?
Why, it's nothing, Mike. It's nothing. Give me that paper, Joe. I got to get to the office. I'm late. Maybe I'm a whole day late. Goodbye, Joe. Good luck. Bye.
Bye.
Well, now, what's the matter with you fellas? Hasn't anybody seen Pop Tell
you, Larry hasn't shown up yet.
But I got to find him. Oh, now, look, fellas. If this is some kind of a joke...
Cut it out, Larry. Will you cut it out? There isn't anybody seen Pop Benson. Besides, what's so important?
Well... It's personal. He gave me something last night, and I got to speak to him about it.
I've got something personal to talk about, too. Get in here, Stevens.
Oh, yes, Mr.
Well, if I see Pop Larry, I'll tell him.
Yeah, it's awful important, Andy. It's awful important.
Stevens, you're late.
Yeah, I know, Mr. Gordon, but I've been looking for Pop Benson. Something's happened. I don't understand
you
how...
You don't, huh? Well, maybe you can understand this. If you're ever late for work again, you can look for another job.
Yes, Mr. Gordon. Look, who's covering the Paderewski concert this afternoon at the Opera House?
Now, don't tell me you want to be a music critic.
But suppose something should happen there, the biggest news of the day.
You think I'd send you... Stevens, you're either drunk or crazy. Maybe both.
I am, huh? Well, Pop Benson gave me something last night, and if you wait a minute, I'll bring it in and show it to you. You'll change your mind fast enough.
I will, eh? You're fired.
I quit. I mean, I'll quit tonight if you haven't given me a raise.
A raise? Why?
Yes,
you...
a raise for being on the job when something sensational happens. You can set up a headline right now. Bandit steal cash at Opera House where Paderewski plays.
Say that again?
Well, what I mean is suppose that something like that did happen. That'd be a good headline, wouldn't it? Bandit steal cash at Opera House where Paderewski plays. And right under it, my byline. I saw it. I mean, I can see it now by Larry Stevens.
Get out of here.
Yes, sir, I'm going. You haven't a thing to worry about, Mr. Gordon. I'll be at the Opera House right on the job.
In a few moments, Mr. DeMille presents Don Amici and Ann Baxter in Act Two of It Happened Tomorrow. Oh, hello, Sally. What's on your mind?
Lux Flakes, of course. And all the things you can Lux around the house. I've made an alphabetical list of some of them. Want to hear it?
Okay. What have you got for A?
Antimacassars.
Huh?
You know those little doilies you put on chair backs? They need Luxing frequently.
Oh, yes. And B?
Bedspreads and blankets. And curtains for C.
Well, what about D?
Draperies and dishes, of course. Lux is so kind to your hands.
E and F?
Enamelware and floors. Lux is especially grand for tiled ones. And G is for glassware and the globes around lights. Wash them often to keep them sparkling.
What about H?
Hairbrushes. Soak them in Lux suds while you're washing your hair.
I and J?
Ice boxes and jars. Always wash jars in Lux before you start canning.
And now K?
Keys, the kind on pianos. Lux takes finger marks off in a jiffy.
L?
Linen, linoleum, lampshades, oh, lots of things.
M?
Mirrors and mantelpieces. Then napkins for N.
O?
Is for oilcloth, to keep it bright. And P is for picture frames, pillow covers, and porcelain.
I'll bet you had a hard time with Q.
No. Quilts.
Right. RST.
Rugs. The cotton chenille bathroom kind. Slip covers and scarves for S. And T for towels and tablecloths. Especially those gay printed ones.
U.
Upholstery. Lots of upholstery fabrics are luxable.
V and W.
Vases, Venetian blinds, woodwork and windows.
And finally, X, Y, and Z.
I'm stumped there, Mr. Kennedy. All I could think of is, for extra long wear, why not give nice things this easy luxe care?
Oh, Sally. But you're right. It's smart and safe to use gentle luxe all around the house. Now, our producer, Mr. DeMille.
Act Two, If It Happened Tomorrow, starring Don Ameche as Larry and Ann Baxter as Sylvia. Stephen's wish to have a copy of tomorrow's newspaper has come true. And on page one is Larry's own byline over the day's biggest news story. The fact that the news event has not yet occurred doesn't bother Larry at all. He's been passing the time writing out an exact copy of what he has just read, so he'll have the facts all ready to hand in when the opera house is held up. Old Pop Benson is still mysteriously absent from the office. But at 1 o'clock, someone else walks in and asks for Larry Stevens.
I'm looking for Mr. Stevens, please.
How does he do it? Larry, she's here.
Who's here?
The angel. Sylvia, I knew it. I knew you'd come.
Aren't you terribly sure of yourself, Mr. Stevens?
Oh, no, please. I didn't mean it that way. I knew you'd be here because everything that isn't possible has been happening. It's a day of miracles.
Well, I just happened to be passing by, and I wanted to tell you that I can't have lunch with you.
Oh, I see. We haven't known each other long enough, huh?
You're a very understanding person.
Yeah, but there's something I have to tell you. It's wonderful. It's fantastic.
It is?
Look, after we have lunch, we'll go to the opera house to hear Paderewski.
You're changing the subject.
Oh, no. No, no, I'm not. That's part of my secret. Something's going to happen at the opera house. Look, we're going to eat. We don't have much time.
I can't go with you, Mr. Stevens. Really, I simply can't. Oh, dear, we're late.
Oh, no. It doesn't happen until 10 minutes after two. We're 2 minutes early.
What doesn't happen? You haven't made a bit of sense yet.
I was going to tell you, but you wouldn't believe it. You've got to see it happen. Then you'll know I'm not crazy.
This way, please. Your ticket, sir?
We're right in the last row, near the door.
Yes, sir.
Far back.
No, it's all right. We'll be leaving soon.
I don't want to leave soon.
But the main attraction will be over.
Paderewski?
Oh, no. Something's going to happen outside the door in the lobby.
What's going to happen?
A holdup.
A holdup?
Yeah, three bandits are coming in.
Oh, Larry, be sensible.
And they'll pretend to ask for tickets, and one of the bandits will draw a gun.
Quiet. I want to listen.
So do I. What time is it?
Exactly 10 minutes after two.
Good. Listen.
Keep your seats, ladies and gentlemen. There's just been a holdup. Keep your seats, please.
Look, Larry, why did you bring me back here with you?
Because Mr. Gordon finishes reading my story, I think I'll need a witness.
But how did you know?
Stevens, what kind of a cock and bull story is this? When did this alleged holdup take place?
10 minutes ago.
And you returned here from the opera house and wrote this all in 10 minutes?
Boss, please, just send that story through now.
Sure, I'll send it through, right straight through to the wastebasket.
Sylvia, tell him what you saw.
Well, I really didn't see anything.
Of course not.
But what I mean is, we were listening to Paderewski play, and before I knew it, it was all over.
What was all over?
The things that Mr. Stevens wrote about.
And it's going to be printed. You'll see it all on page one.
And I'll see you in... Oh, Inspector. Well, come on in. What's doing?
Plenty. There's been a holdup at the opera house.
A holdup?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Andy!
Yes, sir.
Stop the presses! Come here! Quick, come here!
Oh, Mr. Gordon, what's happened?
Oh, wait till I get this story out of the wastebasket. Set it up for page one, four-column spread.
Yeah, what about the headline?
Headline? Yes, headline.
How about bandit steal cash at opera house while Paderewski plays?
That's it.
By Lawrence Stevens.
What? Oh, well, all right, by Lawrence Stevens.
Oh, great work, Larry.
Thanks. And thank you, Inspector. You arrived just in the nick of time.
Yeah, I think so, too. You and me are going to have a little talk, Stevens.
Now?
Now. Johnson, come here.
Larry, isn't that the usher from the opera house?
Oh, yes, the boy. Oh.
This the man you followed here, Johnson?
It certainly is. It most certainly is.
Well, now, just a minute.
Shut up. What were you doing at the opera house during a holdup?
Why, I took this young lady to hear Paderewski.
Don't be modest, Larry. Tell him the truth. Like you told me this morning. He knew just what was going to happen.
Now, boss, please.
Wait. Of course he knew.
I told him about the holdup.
Oh, Sylvia.
And how did you know?
Because it's my business to know the future. We're mind readers, my uncle and I.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So you are. Part Cafe, isn't it?
Yes. Lombardi and Sylvia. Sometimes I can see things that are going to happen. Things like this holdup.
And can you see what's going to happen right now?
No, I'm afraid I can't.
Then let me tell you, sister. Him and you and me, we're heading for police headquarters. Now, for the last time, Stevens, who were those three guys who held up the opera house?
I've told you 100 times I don't know. And where's Sylvia? What are you doing to her?
Nothing. I tend to lose an argument.
Oh. And where's Pop Benson? Why hasn't anybody been able to find him?
I'm asking the questions here. Here. How did you know this holdup was going to happen?
All right, I'll tell you. You won't believe me, but I read about the holdup in a newspaper this morning.
What newspaper?
Tonight's Evening News.
Make a sap out of me, will you? Okay. Stay here, then, and think up some more jokes. O'Neill!
Yes, sir?
Look in on him once in a while. When he's ready to tell the truth, bring it to me.
And now, sir, please to verify Sylvia's statement. What is the number on your watch case?
53241. She's right. I never heard of such a thing.
Thank you very much. Now, does anyone in the audience have any questions? Any questions, please?
Yeah. You make predictions?
Past, present, and the future.
Could you have predicted what happened today the opera house holdup?
Why, sure, Lombardi and Sylvia, we predict those things all the time.
Then suppose you predict me something right now.
Now?
Yeah, something that will happen tonight.
Well, senor, Sylvia is far-sighted. Things that are so close are sometimes out of the focus.
Then how did you two predict today's holdup?
I am so sorry. The next act is waiting. Perhaps you'll come again another time.
I'm not fussy. Predict anything. A crime, a fire, a murder. Whatever you want.
Okay, I try. Sylvia, do you see something that is going to happen tonight?
I can't hear you.
You see, she can't even hear me.
Then speak louder.
Sylvia, try. Try good and hard. What do you see?
Nothing.
That's right, Sylvia. How can anybody see anything? There's no moon tonight.
Why don't you admit it? You're fakes, both of you.
Wait, Professor.
Yes, Sylvia?
I can see now. It is night. This night. I see a river. A bridge. A girl stops at the bridge.
Yes, then what?
She jumps. She's in the water. She goes under. Under. Ah! I don't see her anymore.
A sandwich for you, son. You ready to talk yet?
I tell you, I don't know anything.
Okay. When you change your mind, holler.
Mary. Mary.
Who is it?
Mary. Here I am, outside your window.
Pop.
Shame on you, Larry. In jail.
Now, Pop, tell me the truth. Did I meet you late last night or did I dream it? And tell me, did you give me a newspaper?
It didn't do you any good, did it, Larry?
Pop, I'm in an awful jam. Nobody believes me.
Say, you ought to be on your way to the river by now. You're supposed to be there a little after midnight. In fact, you've got to be.
Well, who says so?
Why, I just read it in this newspaper.
What newspaper? Not tomorrow's Evening News again.
Isn't that what you want?
No. Yes. Does it say anything about the bandits?
Yes, right here. Says they've been caught.
It does. Where? When?
Tomorrow morning, the Union Bank. The police were waiting for them. You wrote all about it.
I did?
Oh, you'll be a hero.
What, for telling the police?
Oh, no, for something else. Listen, I'll read it to you. Unknown girl makes suicide jump. Leaps to death from 9th Street Bridge. Larry Stevens, Evening News reporter, makes heroic attempt at rescue. Girl's body not recovered.
Well, I don't believe that.
Says so right here, Larry.
Yeah, but I'm in jail. And even if I got out of jail, I wouldn't go risking my life jumping in the river for a girl I know I can't save. What kind of a monkey do you think I am?
Don't ask me, boy. I'm no prophet. I'm just reading what it says.
Hey, who are you talking to? What's the matter with you?
Well, he's gone. Pop's gone.
Huh?
But he was standing right there outside. Wait a second. Look, if you let me out, I'll tell you where you can get those guys who pulled the hole up.
Well, now we're getting somewhere.
Union Bank, tomorrow morning. All you have to do is wait for them.
Union Bank, huh? Come on, Stevens. You and me's going to find the inspector.
Why isn't he here?
Oh, he's at the Park Cafe with the mind readers.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston gives you real flavor, full rich tobacco flavor. Winston's easy drawing too. The filter lets the flavor through. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Come on, Stevens. You and me's going to find the inspector.
Why isn't he here?
Oh, he's at the Park Cafe with the mind readers, Professors Lombardi and Sylvia.
Stevens, all right. So we'll be at the bank. But if you're lying, remember, we know where to pick you up.
Yes, sir. Oh, where's Sylvia, Professor?
Gone home. I think she's gone home.
One thing more. Just when did she first tell you about the holdup going to happen at the Opera House?
Why, she never mentioned that.
Holdup? How could Sylvia know such crazy business?
What this is? A few minutes ago when you did your act up there in the States, I asked could you make predictions and you said sure.
How could we know then that you was cops?
You mean the prediction was a fake?
Fake? I don't like that word.
Look, and all that stuff she gave me about a bridge, a girl jumping into the river, that was plain hooey.
Sylvia said that?
Yeah.
Sure it was hooey.
But a bridge? A river?
Shut your mouth. She was just trying to get us all out of a tight squeeze. You too.
The body. Did she say the body would never be found?
No.
She didn't know. Oh, that poor girl. She didn't know.
Now, where's he going?
You're the mind reader. You tell me.
She jumped in. I saw her.
Officer.
Oh, hurry.
Come, everybody. I'll get her.
Oh, she'll drown. You're too late. She'll drown.
Now, wait till I get these shoes off. Can you see her, anybody?
No, she's disappeared.
Somebody find a rowboat. I'll save her.
No,
I know you won't save her.
Oh, you do, huh? Who are you?
Larry Stevens, Evening News. Sorry, I have to cut this conversation short. Sylvia. Ouch.
Be careful. That's a duck.
Yeah, so I found out. Where are you?
Over here, by the piling.
Are you all right?
Yes. But what are you doing here? You spoiled everything.
Oh, Sylvia, darling, I knew you were in danger.
But I wasn't. I was just trying to save you. I had to make a prediction, and then I had to make it really happen.
Oh, you wonderful, foolish darling.
Hey, yeah, that looks like a hat floating over there.
Shh, they're looking for me.
Yeah, they've got a rowboat.
Hey, what happened to that reporter fella?
Don't move.
That's a hat, all right. The girl must have sunk like a stone. Yeah, it's another of them cases. Body not recovered.
Did you hear that?
That's what I want you to think.
Body not recovered. And Pop's newspaper was right.
I don't know what you're talking about. They won't be right if they find me here. Now, sure.
Oh, don't worry. They won't find you. The paper said so. Come on. Come on, let's get out of here. I'm supposed to be at the bank first thing tomorrow morning.
Have they found Stephen's body yet, Andy?
No, nor the girls either. They're still dragging the river.
If they haven't found him yet, I guess they never will.
What a swell fella. Jumping in the river to save some girl who didn't want to live anyway.
He'd have made a fine reporter. Yeah. Fine reporter.
Hey, what's all the excitement?
Mr. Gordon, look, it's Larry.
Late for work again,
Larry,
I see.
Larry, you're not drowning. It was the cops that told us.
Hello, Andy. How are you? Mr. Gordon,
fine.
Look, I got a great story. Do I have a job?
Sure, you've got a job.
And a raise?
Yes, but what's the story?
The police just trapped those Opera House bandits.
Where?
Right where I was, the Union Bank.
Sit down, write it. Give them room, boys, and kill his obituary.
Obituary?
Sure, you would know last night, remember?
Oh, yeah. I tried to find the cops after I got out of the river.
Start writing, Larry, and change those headlines, Sweeney. Okay. Larry Stevens, Evening News reporter, makes heroic attempt at rescue in river. Now, get on that bank story, Larry. We got to make the first edition.
Come on, let's go, Larry, will you? It's late. Everybody's left.
Oh, I just thought if I hung around the office here, maybe Pop would show up. Better not wait for me, Andy.
Okay. But first, you got to tell me something.
What's that?
How come you were at the Union Bank this morning?
Oh, just passing by.
Uh-huh. And how did you happen to be on the 9th Street Bridge last night just when that woman jumped in?
Well, same reason, just passing by.
Hmm. And you were just passing by the Opera House yesterday afternoon, too, huh?
Well, I guess I just have a nose for news.
Oh, come on, pal, come on. How'd you do it?
You really want to know?
Do I?
All right, I'll tell you the truth. Do you believe in miracles?
No.
But that's what it must have been. Andy, anything I want to know, I can find out.
Oh, you can, huh? Then how come you had to go to the boss for $100 advance?
Well, because one of these days, Sylvia and I are going to be married, and soon, too.
I see. And just anything you want to know, you can find out. But you have to borrow $100 to get married.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Look, if what you said is true, you can have a fortune.
A fortune?
Sure, by picking the winners at the racetrack tomorrow. Let's see you do that, Miracle Man.
Gee, I hadn't thought of that. Gosh, Andy, thanks. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and I got a better one. Turn out the lights and go on home.
Yeah, I will, a little later on.
So long, Larry.
So long, Andy.
Larry.
Pop.
Can't stay here long, Larry. Can't stay here long.
Want something, boy?
Pop, I'm all mixed up in something I don't understand, but I'm not going to ask any questions. All I want is one more paper, Pop, please, and I'll never ask you again.
I've got a paper here, Larry, but I don't think you should have it.
Oh, it can make me rich. It can give me everything I want.
Since when can money do that?
Well, I've got everything else. I'm in love. Sylvia's going to marry me. Give it to me, Pop.
Larry, you shouldn't have grabbed that paper from me.
I'm sorry, Pop.
Remember, you took it from me. I didn't give it to you. What are you looking for?
I'm looking for the races. I want to know what horses they've been on.
Larry, look on the front page. The front page. It's a late extra.
Why, what's on the front page?
Right there, you see?
Larry Stevens shot to death at St. George Hotel. Pop.
That's why I didn't want you to have it, Larry.
At 6:25 tonight, Larry Stevens, Evening News reporter, was shot to death in the lobby of the St. George Hotel. What, Pop?
Goodbye, Larry.
Pop, come back. Pop. Pop.
We pause now for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. After a brief intermission, Mr. DeMille returns with Don Ameche and Ann Baxter for Act 3 of It Happened Tomorrow. Now, here's Sue, just starting to Lux's address when...
Wouldn't you know, the minute my hands are wet. All right, I'm coming. Hello? Oh, hi, Mary. No, I was right here, but I just started to wash a dress. My hands were all wet. Oh, that's all right. Thursday night? Why, yes, I think so. What time? Okay, I'll tell Bill. Who? No, she did. Well, look, can I call you back and hear the rest of that later? My ears are simply flapping, but I don't want that dress to soak. It's that white rayon one with the big red roses on it. Oh, sure, I've washed it lots of times already. Thanks, pal, but it's not new. No, I wore it all last summer. Well, Bill says it's still so bright you can see me a block away. Yep, I was kind of scared the first time I washed it, but I tested the material and... Oh, simple. You just squeeze the belt or something in a glass of lukewarm water for a couple of minutes, and if you can't see any color in the water, why, then it's safe to Lux the whole thing. Uh-huh. Lux. Oh, yes, I swear by it for colors, especially prints. I wouldn't dare use hot water or strong soap on this dress. Why, the roses would probably ramble right off in 2 seconds if I did. Oh, look, chum, I gotta go. I'll call you back later. Bye now. See you Thursday. Bye-bye.
Now, if Sue had only said that Lux keeps colors new-looking up to 3 times longer... I wouldn't have to add anything. But maybe she hasn't heard about those actual washing tests we made. How the fabrics that were washed according to harsh wash day methods looked faded and washed out, while the ones that were luxed stayed bright and lovely. It all goes to prove colors lead a long life when they lead a lux life. Now, Mr. DeMille returns to the microphone.
A chat with our stars is the order of the evening after the play. But here's the curtain for the third act of It Happened Tomorrow. Starring Don Ameche and Ann Baxter. It's later the same night. Larry has read and reread 2 items in tomorrow's evening news until he knows them by heart. On the sports page, the race results reveal that by tomorrow night, he'll be a rich man. But on the front page is the slightly more disquieting fact that at 6:25, he'll also be a dead man. Now a glassy-eyed, nervous wreck, he rushes to Sylvia's boarding house.
Larry!
Sylvia, darling, I love you. And something wonderful has happened. I mean, something awful. I mean, it's going to happen, and I don't have much time.
So, it's you!
Hello, Uncle, hello. Sylvia, say you'll marry me tomorrow, please.
Well, of course I will, darling, but why so soon?
Well, it's just that...
Well, a man should provide for his widow, his wife. And there's so many things to do. Get a license, get married, go to the racetrack, be at the St. George Hotel, and... Oh.
Larry, aren't you feeling well?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm just fine.
But you're shivering. Are you cold?
Not as cold as I'll be tomorrow night.
Hey, you got any money? You think you can support a wife?
Oh, sure, sure.
How much in the bank?
In the bank? Well, nothing, but I got $100 right here, see? Besides, by tomorrow night, I'll be rich.
What difference does it make how much money he has? We'll get along fine, darling.
Oh, sure we will. Uncle, have you ever predicted 5 winners at the racetrack?
So, a gambler.
Oh, no, no, a gambler can lose. I can't. You see this list? These are the 5 horses that are going to win tomorrow afternoon.
They are, huh?
Of course.
Darling, what's the matter? Aren't you happy? Are you sure you want to get married?
Sylvia, let's get married right now, tonight. Then I've got to get away.
Get away? Where?
Oh, anywhere, as long as it's far away from the St. George Hotel.
But I thought you said you had to be there tomorrow night. Was it business, Larry?
Business? Well, kind of. But maybe they can do without me. I don't think they can, but if I'm not there, they'll have to.
Well, then we'll get married tonight.
Oh, thank you, Sylvia.
There's only one thing.
What's that?
Where's the minister?
Oh, you darling.
I now pronounce you man and wife. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you. We're terribly sorry to have had to wake you up.
Fate has no regard for the clock, my dear.
Oh, how right you are, sir. How right.
Mr. Stevens, it does my heart good to see you so serious. Marriage is a serious business. It's meant to last a lifetime.
It is, huh?
Now, if there's nothing else I can do...
Yeah, but there is. Just one more thing. You can draw up my will.
Larry!
But it's a very sensible step to take, Mrs. Stevens.
Well, of course it is. I want everything left to my widow.
If you'll just wait here, I'll be right back with the four.
Professor?
What?
About the races.
Races? People don't go to races on their honeymoon.
I know. That's why you'll have to go instead.
You think I'm crazy, too? I won't go.
Oh, you have to go. Don't you want Sylvia to be rich? It's her last chance.
But, Larry, darling, there'll be other times, lots of other times.
Professor, Uncle, please.
You can throw away your $100 yourself, not me.
All right, I'll go. But as soon as we get back...
Yes?
I'll have to get myself locked up tight, so I can't possibly get out.
If you ask me, that should have been done years ago.
Sylvia, here they are, the bookmakers.
Sylvia, haven't you any influence on him? $100 to his name, and he's going to bet it all on the first race.
Oh, Larry, do you have to? The whole $100?
Darling, it's not a bet. This is a sure thing. Can I place a bet with you?
A pleasure, Jack. How much on who?
$100, Lamplighter, to win.
Get out of here. Can't you see the board? Lamplighter won 5 minutes ago. They told me the first race was at 2:30.
So we lost a few $1,000. Anyway, did I know the winner or didn't I?
How about picking a winner in the second race, Jack?
That's a cinch. Mudlark.
My odds are 20 to 1.
20 to 1, okay. $100 on Mudlark.
Come on, Larry, let's go to the grandstand. Gee, I'm excited.
Well, there's really no point watching the race, darling. Mudlark can't lose.
Oh, sure as death and taxes, huh?
Now, why did you have to say that?
$1,900, $1,950, $2,000.
There
you are, Jack,
$2,000. Oh, Larry... $2,000.
If I had your luck, my friend, I'd ride it.
That's just what I'm going to do. Lightning in the third.
Spoken like a sport. $2,000 to win. All right, step right up. Who's next? Highest strike odds. Who's next?
Oh, Larry, again? You think you should? I've never seen so much money in my life.
Oh, you're going to see a lot more, honey. All right, Bucky, the whole lot of Ramona. 4 to 1.
3 to 1. That's the best I can do.
Okay, 3 to 1 on Ramona.
I can't stand it. I just can't stand it.
We've won 3 races already. Larry must be right.
So Ramona won, and he's got all that. Oh, Larry, be satisfied.
But all we've got is $30,000.
Oh, this is wonderful. Everything's happening just the way you said it would.
Yeah, everything. Bookie.
Yeah?
$30,000 on Black Flash on the nose.
Black Flash. Even money. Okay, Jack, but I never heard of anybody picking 4 winners in a row.
Well, this is a sure thing. I saw it in tomorrow's newspaper.
Okay, Jack, it's your funeral.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Larry, I'm so
sorry.
Him and his big tips. Get away from me.
Black Flash lost. He lost.
What are you so happy about?
We're always going to be happy. What if he did lose?
Yeah, but you don't understand. If the sport page is wrong, the front page can be wrong, too, and I'm not going to be shot.
Larry, what do you mean? You're not going to be...
Ladies and gentlemen, the judges have the following announcement to make.
Larry, what you just said about...
Quiet.
Diablo, number 7, has just been disqualified. The winner of the race, Black Flash.
Get out of here, Stevens. I'm warning you.
But I tell you, I was robbed, Inspector. My wallet, $60,000.
You? $60,000? What kind of a sucker do you think I am?
But it's the truth. This guy in the check suit, just as we were leaving the racetrack...
You also told me you had 4 straight winners.
He did. $60,000. Then this man grabbed his wallet out of his hand.
And how come you were arrested for speeding?
He told you how come, because we spotted this guy and our cabbie chased him all the way into town.
Yeah, and he got away, huh?
Certainly he got away. You allow the thief to get away and you arrest the victims.
Okay, then you ain't arrested anymore. Go on, feed it, all 3 of it. You're driving me nuts.
Wait a minute. What time is it?
6:10. Now get out of here.
No. I demand my rights. I was legally arrested. Now lock me up and don't let me out of this jail until tomorrow.
Oh, Larry, it's our honeymoon.
6:10. Inspector, please, lock me up for just 1 hour. Just 1 hour.
If I lock you up, it'll be in the bughouse. Maroney, Schultz, call the riot squad. Get these people out of my police station.
Stevens, where in thunderation have you been? Look at that clock.
I don't have to. I know what time it is. It's 6:00.
A fine time to come to work. How long do you expect to hold down your job?
Not very much longer. Mr. Gordon, I got married this morning. My widow and her uncle are waiting for me downstairs.
You what?
I wouldn't have come here at all except...
Oh, fine.
Except I gotta find Pop Benson.
Pop Benson? You haven't heard?
Heard what?
Why, Pop's dead.
He's dead?
Yes, we found out just this afternoon. Old age, I guess.
Oh, Mr. When?
When? Why, 3 nights ago.
3 nights ago?
Sure, the night of the William Jennings Bryan speech.
That same night? You're sure?
Why, of course I'm sure. Oh, don't take it so hard. When they found the old man, they said he had a smile on his face.
Smile on his face,
yeah. Stevens, you've done some mighty good work recently, but I simply cannot tolerate the way you've been acting. I'm afraid all this has gone to your head. But I'm giving you one more chance. Wife or no wife, I've got an assignment for you tonight, right away.
Yeah, I know. At the St. George Hotel.
It certainly is not the St. George Hotel. It's the other side of town.
You mean you're not sending me to the St. George Hotel?
Didn't you hear what I just said?
Mr. Gordon, aren't you making a mistake?
Are you insane? It's at the McIntyre Foundation. Get a cab and get over there right away.
All right, but I'm afraid I'm going to wind up at the St. George Hotel at 6:25, no matter where I go.
St. George Hotel, huh? Stevens, forget that assignment.
What?
Go to the St. George Hotel.
Well, what for?
Oh, you know what for, my boy. If you said the St. George Hotel, you must have had a mighty good reason to say the St. George Hotel.
No.
You can't fool me. Now, hurry up. I don't want you to be late. Stick around, boys. We'll be getting out an extra tonight. I just know we will.
Larry.
Why, what's
right downstairs, Sylvia. I was down there talking to her, and all of a sudden she saw some guy down the street in a check suit, and then she and her uncle started yelling, stop thief, and they ran off after him.
Did they catch him?
I don't know. She just yelled that I should get a hold of you.
Oh, thanks a lot, Eddie. What direction were they going?
Down toward the alley off of Park Street. If you run fast, you can catch up to her.
$60,000, I'll sprout wings. Sylvia. Professor, wait. Wait for me, wait.
Hey, Larry. He went down this alley.
He's the one, Larry. I saw his face. He ducked into that door.
What door?
That one. The rear entrance to that building there.
Call the police and then wait right here.
Oh, Larry, be careful, darling. Please.
He's got a gun, Larry. I saw it.
Don't worry. I can't get shot tonight except in the St. George Hotel.
There he goes. He's going after him, Sylvia.
What did he mean? He can't get shot except in the...
Sylvia. But that's it. That's the back of his door.
Hello? Who? Larry Stevens? Why, yes, I sent him to the St. George Hotel myself. What? He was on an assignment, of course. Dead? Well, the man's a hero. He knew something big was going to happen to St. George. Never mind, I'll be right over.
Oh, what's happened, Mr. Gordon? Is it Larry again?
Yes, boys, it's Larry again. But for the last time, I'm afraid. Johnson, take down this headline. Larry Stevens, evening news reporter, shot to death in the lobby of the St. George Hotel.
Oh, I
Joe, stop. Stop, stop, please, stop.
Ah, no, it's all right, fella, it's all right. How'd you get that lump on your head, huh?
Oh, he started shooting, and I ducked into the freight elevator, except the freight elevator wasn't there.
You okay?
Yeah, I guess so, I guess. But catch him. He'll get away. He's got a check suit. $60,000.
Check suit, huh? Yeah. Now, don't worry, fella. Now, he was knocked out, a lot's been happening. He's caught. Dead in a fish, too.
Dead?
Sure. House detective tried to stop him. And shot it out in the lobby.
House detective? Where? Hmm? Where are we?
Where? We're the St. George Hotel.
The St. Oh. This fellow who was killed... do I know who he was?
Sure, from the wallet in his pocket. Newspaper reporter, Larry Stevens. Hey, Sarge, come here. He passed out again. I better get him inside. I think the inspector would like to see this bird.
This is awful, Stevens, awful. I rushed over to this hotel because you're supposed to be dead.
Yeah, I know, Mr. Gordon. They say I am. What do you think?
A fine reporter. Our extra with your death story will be on the streets in 5 minutes, and you haven't even got a slight fever.
Stevens!
Hello, Inspector.
Is this it? Is this yours?
Yeah, of course it is. My wallet. The one I told you was stolen.
And how did it get in the pocket of the man who was killed?
I told you before. When I stopped at the police station, it was stolen.
Stevens, I'm getting awful tired of you.
Pop's newspaper makes sense. It all makes sense.
Crazy as a bat.
You know, you're a wonderful man, Inspector. I love you. I love everybody. Now, where's my wife? Where's Sylvia?
Probably in that mob outside.
Can I go now?
Can you go? I give you just 10 seconds to clear out of here.
Thank you. Hey, look, my money, it's gone. Where's my $60,000?
What 60? Oh, Neil, if this nimblewit ain't out of here in 10 seconds, arrest him for vagrancy.
Larry, oh, darling.
Ah, honey, it's all right now. Everything's all right now. Come on, we'll get a hansom cab and go home.
We can't take a hansom cab, darling. We haven't any money.
Oh, that's right. Gee, I'd sure like to know what happened to that $60,000.
Who cares? It didn't seem real anyway.
No. Came in like a dream and went out like a dream. Well, it's a fine wedding night. No money, no umbrella, no nothing.
Nothing but a wonderful future.
Darling, if you don't mind, let's not think about the future.
It's just when I'm close to you, Larry, like this, I feel I can really look way ahead, years and years.
And what do you see? Are we happy?
We'll always be happy.
Just you and me?
Oh, no. I want at least 4 sons.
Oh, it's fine. Can we afford them?
Of course we can. And grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I can almost see them. 50 years from tonight, our golden wedding anniversary.
Yeah, our golden wedding anniversary.
Mary.
Pop.
My. Married 50 years. Better get downstairs, boy. They're waiting for you. Your children and their children. And even their children.
Yes. Thanks, Pop.
Larry. Did you say something, darling?
No. May I have your arm, darling? We mustn't keep them waiting.
And your story, Larry. Are you going to tell them about it?
No. They wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't believe it.
Before our stars return for a curtain call, Lippy Collins is going to answer a question a young war worker raised recently.
It's a question of time, Miss Collins. I don't mind washing my slips every time I wear them, but it takes so long to iron them, and if I don't, they look rumpled.
Why not try the new nylon slips? You know, the ones made from parachute cloth released by the government. You can Lux nylon the flash. Dries in almost no time. Looks smooth without ironing.
How about when I wear slacks?
Oh, knit undies are what you need. No bumps or bulges, and they keep heavy work clothes from chafing your skin.
Well, I suppose I'll just have to be the tailored type till the war's over.
Oh, no, indeed. Even practical undies come with lace, faggoting, eyelet embroidery, or ruffles. You'd be surprised how trim, smart, and feminine-looking they are. And jersey nighties, which need no ironing either, come in yummy colors and pretty prints, too. Of course, use Lux Flakes for all undies.
That's right, Libby. Actual washing tests showed the amazing difference Lux Care makes. Lux undies stayed lovely 3 times longer than those washed the wrong way.
strong soaps, too hot water, and rough handling faded color badly. In some cases, straps were frayed, too, and seams pulled out.
So you see, a Lux life
means a long life for undies.
Now, here's Mr. DeMille with our stars.
The curtain has fallen on another season of the Lux Radio Theater. And the stars who made this such a happy occasion return to the spotlight now. Don Ameche and Ann Baxter.
Thank you, C.B. That's a fine reputation you're giving us. Closing up the place for the summer as soon as we get through.
Well, that's why you two are here, Don.
Yeah.
So we'd be sure the audience would want us back in the fall.
Ann, you ever closed the theater before?
Well, I haven't had much chance, Don. I was only on Broadway a short time before I came out here.
An accomplished actress at 16.
I don't think so, Mr. DeMille. In my very first picture, John Barrymore gave me a lesson in acting.
You picked a good teacher.
I guess I was waving my arms around too much in this particular scene. And Mr. Barrymore stood it as long as he could, and he stopped the camera and said, "My dear, do you have to swim?"
And so you stopped swimming?
Yes, except in the water.
Well, isn't that the way most actors begin, Don? Somebody throws them in and they sink or swim?
Well, it's the way I got my first job, C.B. I was standing in line in the theater to buy a ticket one morning when the manager came out and saw me there. And he says, "Hey, you, come on backstage. The leading man has been in an accident. You've got a job."
That's amazing. And he didn't even know you.
Oh, sure. He was an old friend of mine. Well, C.B., don't work too hard this summer. I'll see you in the fall.
Good night, Mr. DeMille.
Good night. Good night. We'll see you next season. On the eve of our Independence Day, we leave you for the summer. Before the lights go on again in this theater, great events may happen. The forces of right are arrayed against the forces of evil on the field of battle. And the fate of the world for 100 years to come hangs in the balance. The news is good, but nowhere is the task completed. And until it is, all America must unite to that end. Our job is to provide wholesome relaxation. And whatever contribution the Lux Radio Theater can make in this direction will be given with every ounce of effort at our command when the curtain rises on the new season in September. About 450 plays have been presented here by the makers of Lux Flakes and Lux Toilet Soap. And literally thousands of parts in those dramas have been filled by the finest stars and supporting players in Hollywood. During this year, the Lux Radio Theater has won its share of awards for excellence. The latest of these is the George Foster Peabody Award for Outstanding Entertainment in Drama, one of the most distinguished honors yet to come our way. But I think we would fail in our duty to you if we didn't look upon these honors as a challenge for the future. And so, until we meet again, our hearts like yours must be with the sons and daughters of America, wherever they may be, and our hopes like yours for their speedy return. And now, to all our friends everywhere, our sponsors, the makers of Lux Flakes and Lux Toilet Soap, join me in an invitation to be with us again on Monday, September 4th, when the Lux Radio Theater begins its fourth season. It's fall season. This is Cecil B. DeMille saying good night to you from Hollywood.
Now that cheese and choice cuts of lamb are back on the ration list and beef points raised, those 30 red points a month don't go very far, do they? But you can get extra points by turning in your used kitchen fat. Yes, your butcher will give you 2 red tokens plus 4 cents for every pound of used fat. Our all-out offensive in Europe means your used kitchen fats are needed more urgently than ever. Needed in the making of ammunition, medicine, synthetic rubber, hundreds of things our fighting men use every day. So let's do an all-out job of backing our men. Save more used fat than ever now. Don Ameche will soon be seen in the 20th Century Fox picture, Wing and a Prayer. Ann Baxter appears through the courtesy of 20th Century Fox, producers of Darrell F. Zanuck's Technicolor production, Wilson. Heard in tonight's play were Norman Field, Eddie Marr, Griff Barnett, Leo Cleary, Ferdinand Bunier, Kathy Lewis, Ken Christie, Charles Seal, Franklin Parker, Tyler McVeigh, Ed Emerson, and Herb Litton. This program is broadcast to our fighting forces overseas through cooperation with the Armed Forces Radio Service. Our music was directed by Louis Silvers, and this is your announcer, John N. Kennedy, reminding you to tune in again on Monday, September 4th, when the Lux Radio Theater opens its new fall season.
The biggest news in cake making. New Easy Mix Spry Shortening. You get lighter, better tasting cakes that stay fresh longer. And new Spry cuts mixing time 2/3. No creaming, no long tiresome beating. At your grocer's in the same handy jar, new Easy Mix Spry. Grand for all baking and frying. By Spry. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now. But we'll be back real soon. The Saucer of Loneliness is a short story published by Theodore Sturgeon in Galaxy Magazine for February of 1953, and is a story that has been adapted for radio at least three times that I know of. The first time was for X-1 in 1957, then again in the 70s for the revival program Future Tense, and was also done on the Twilight Zone revival in 1986. But for my money, the best adaptation comes from a 1979 adaptation for Mindwebs, probably the most faithful of all of the adaptations. But that's in the nature of the program, Mindwebs, which essentially took short stories, added a little bit of music, brought in a small cast to dramatize the voices, and essentially read the story. So, here, from February the 25th of 1979, is Mindwebs' adaptation of The Saucer of Loneliness. Actually, I think the original title is A Saucer of Loneliness. My bad.
Tonight is A Saucer of Loneliness by Theodore Sturgeon. Copyright 1953 by Galaxy Publishing Company. If he's dead, I thought, if he's dead, I'll never find her in this white flood of moonlight on the white sea, with the surf seething in and over the pale, pale sand like a great shampoo. Almost always, suicides who stab themselves or shoot themselves in the heart carefully bare their chests. The same strange impulse generally makes the sea suicide go naked. A little earlier, I thought, or later, and there would be shadows for the dunes and the breathing toss of the foam. Now the only real shadow was mine. A tiny thing just under me, but black enough to feed the blackness of the shadow of a blimp. A little earlier, I thought, and I might have seen her plotting up the silver shore, seeking a place lonely enough to die in. A little later, and my legs would rebel against this shuffling trot through sand, the maddening sand that could not hold and would not help a hurrying man. My legs did give way then, and I knelt suddenly, sobbing, not for her, not yet, just for air. There was such a rush about me. Wind and tangled spray and colors upon colors and shades of colors that were not colors at all, but shifts of white and silver. If light like that were sound, it would sound like the sea on sand. And if my ears were eyes, they would see such a light. I crouched there, gasping in the swirl of it, and a flood struck me, shallow and swift, turning up and outward like flower petals where it touched my knees, then soaking to the waist in its bubble and crash. I pressed my knuckles to my eyes so they would open again. The sea was on my lips with a taste of tears, and the whole white night shouted and wept aloud. And there she was. Her white shoulders were a taller curve in the soaking foam. She must have sensed me, perhaps I yelled, for she turned and saw me kneeling there. She put her fists to her temples and her face twisted, and she uttered a piercing wail of despair and fury, and then plunged seaward and sank. I kicked off my shoes and ran into the breakers, shouting, hunting, grasping at flashes of white that turned to sea salt and coldness in my fingers. I plunged right past her, and her body struck my side as a wave whipped my face and tumbled both of us. I gasped in solid water, opened my eyes beneath the surface, and saw a greenish-white distorted moon hurtle as I spun. Then there was sucking sand under my feet again, and my left hand was tangled in her hair. She hit my ear, wet, hard, and a huge pointed pain lanced into my head. She pulled, she lunged away from me, and all the while my hand was caught in her hair. I couldn't have freed her if I'd wanted to. She spun to me with the next wave, battered and clawed at me, and we went into deeper water. Don't, I can't swim, I told her, and she clawed me again.
Leave me alone. Oh, dear God, why can't you leave me alone?
So by her hair, I pulled her head down tight to her white shoulder, and with the edge of my free hand, I hit her neck twice. She floated again, and I brought her ashore. I carried her to where a dune was between us and the sea's broad, noisy tongue, and the wind was above us somewhere. But the light was as bright. I rubbed her wrists and stroked her face and said, it's all right. The hair and some names I used to have for a dream I had long, long before I ever heard of her.
Why couldn't you leave me alone?
And she opened her eyes and looked at me at last. She had so much misery, and there was no room for fear. She shut her eyes again and said,
you know who I am.
I know, I said. And she began to cry. I waited a long time, and when she stopped crying, there were shadows among the dunes.
You don't know who I am. Nobody knows who I am.
It was in all the papers.
That. Nobody knows who I am.
Well, tell me.
Who are you?
Someone who...
Well?
Not now. Later, maybe.
Where are my clothes?
I didn't see them.
Oh, I remember. I put them down and kicked sand over them. Just where a dune would come and smooth them over. Hide them as if they never were. I hate sand. I wanted to drown in the sand, but it wouldn't let me. You mustn't look at me. I hate to have you looking at me. I can't stay here like this. What can I do? Where can I go?
Here. And she let me help her up and then snatched her hand away, half turned from me.
Don't touch me. Get away from me.
Here. I said again, and walked down the dune where it curved in the moonlight, tipped back into the wind and down and became not dune but beach. Here. And I pointed behind the dune. At last, she followed me. She peered over the dune where it was chest high and again where it was knee high.
Back there? It's so dark.
She stepped over the low dune and into the aching black of those moon shadows. She moved away cautiously, feeling tenderly with her feet back to where the dune was higher. She sank down into the blackness and disappeared there, and I sat on the sand in the light.
Stay away from me.
I rose and stepped back. Invisible in the shadows, she breathed.
Don't go away. There, over there, in the dark. Just be a... Stay away from me now. Be a voice.
I did as she asked and sat in the shadows perhaps 6 feet from her. She told me about it, not the way it was in the papers. She was perhaps 17 when it happened. She was in Central Park in New York. It was too warm for such an early spring day, and the hammered brown slopes had a dusting of green of precisely the consistency of that morning's hoarfrost on the rocks. But the frost was gone, and the grass was brave and tempted some hundreds of pairs of feet from the asphalt and concrete to tread on it. Hers were among them, The sprouting soil was a surprise to her feet, as the air was to her lungs. Her feet ceased to be shoes as she walked. Her body was consciously more than clothes. It was the only kind of day which, in itself, can make a city-bred person raise his eyes. She did. For a moment, she felt separated from the life she lived, in which there was no fragrance, no silence, in which nothing ever quite fit, nor was quite filled. In that moment, the ordered disapproval of the buildings around the Pallid Park could not reach her. For 2-3 clean breaths, it no longer mattered that the whole wide world really belonged to images projected on a screen, to gently groomed goddesses in these steel and glass towers, that it belonged, in short, always, always, to someone else. So she raised her eyes, and there, above her, was the saucer. It was beautiful. It was golden, with a dusty finish like that of an unripe Concord grape. It made a faint sound, a chord composed of two tones and a blunted hiss, like the wind in tall wheat. It was darting about like a swallow, soaring and dropping. It circled and dropped and hovered like a fish, shimmering. It was like all these living things, but with all that beauty it had all the loveliness of things turned and burnished, measured, machined, and metrical. At first she felt no astonishment, for this was so different from anything she had ever seen before that it had to be a trick of the eye, a false evaluation of size and speed and distance that in a moment would resolve itself into a sun flash on an airplane or the lingering glare of a welding arc. She looked away from it and abruptly realized that many other people saw it, saw something too. She looked up again and at last began to realize how large and how far away the saucer was. No, rather, how small and how very near it was. It was just the size of the largest circle she might make with her two hands, and it floated not quite 18 inches over her head. Fear came then. She drew back and raised a forearm, but the saucer simply hung there. She bent far sideways, twisted away, leaped forward, looked back and upward to see if she had escaped it. At first, she couldn't see it. Then as she looked up and up, there it was, close and gleaming, quivering and crooning right over her head. She bit her tongue. From the corner of her eye, she saw a man cross himself. And she thought, he did that because he saw me standing here with a halo over my head. And that was the greatest single thing that had ever happened to her. No one had ever looked at her and made a respectful gesture before. Not once, not ever. Through terror, through panic and wonderment, the comfort of that thought nestled into her to wait to be taken out and looked at again in lonely times. The terror was uppermost now, however. She backed away, staring upward, stepping on a ludicrous cakewalk. She should have collided with people. There were plenty of people there, gasping and craning, but she reached none. She spun around and discovered, to her horror, that she was the center of a pointing, pressing crowd. Its mosaic of eyes all bulged, and its inner circle braced its many legs to press back and away from her. The saucer's gentle note deepened. It tilted, dropped an inch or so. Someone screamed, and the crowd broke away from her in all directions, milled about and settled again in a new dynamic balance, a much larger ring as more and more people raced to thicken it against the efforts of the inner circle to escape. The saucer hummed and tilted, tilted. She opened her mouth to scream, fell to her knees, and the saucer struck. It dropped against her forehead and clung there. It seemed almost to lift her. She came erect on her knees, made one effort to raise her hands against it, and then her arms stiffened down and back, her hands not reaching the ground. For perhaps a second and a half, the saucer held her rigid. And then it passed a single ecstatic quiver to her body and dropped it. She plumped to the ground, the backs of her thighs heavy and painful on her heels and ankles. The saucer dropped beside her, rolled once in a small circle, once just around its edge, and lay still. It lay still and dull and metallic, different and dead. Hazily she lay and gazed at the gray, shrouded blue of the good spring sky, and hazily she heard whistles and some tardy screams and a great stupid voice that bellowed, "Give her air!" which made everyone press closer. Then there wasn't so much sky because of the blue-clad bulk with its metal buttons and its leatherette notebook. Okay. What's happened here? Stand back, for God's sake. And the widening ripples of observation, interpretation, and comment.
And knocked her down. Some guy knocked her down. You knocked her down. Some guy knocked her down and... right in broad daylight, this guy. The park's getting to be...
Onward and outward. The adulteration of fact until it was lost altogether because excitement is so much more important. The glittering shield in the florid face, bending close. Are you hurt bad? And the echoes back and back through the crowd. Hurt bad. Badly injured. He beat the hell out of her in broad daylight. And then another man, slim and purposeful in tan gabardine, cleft chin and beard shadow. Flying saucer, hmm? Okay, officer, I'll take over here. FBI. And that rippled outward, too. The policeman nodded. The entire policeman nodded in one single bobbing genuflection. FBI. FBI. The crowd murmured. There was more sky to look at above her. She sat up, and there was glory in her face. And she sang, "The saucer talked to me." "He'll be quiet," said the gabardine. "He'll be quiet now. You'll have lots of chance to talk later."
"Yeah, sister,"
said the policeman.
"Oh, my God, this mob could be full of communists, you know."
"You be quiet, too," said the gabardine. Someone in the crowd told someone else a communist beat up this woman, while someone else was saying she got beat up because she was a communist. She started to rise, but solicitous hands forced her down again. There were 30 police there by that time, and she told them that she could walk, and they told her to take it easy. At the hospital, she had a bedroom to herself then for the first time in her life. Whenever the door opened, she could see a policeman outside. It opened very often to admit the kind of civilians who were very polite to military people and the kind of military people who were even more polite to certain civilians. She did not know what they all did, nor what they wanted. Every single day, they asked her 4,500,000 questions. Apparently, they never talked to each other because each of them asked her the same questions over and over. There would be a lot of shouting ones, and then a lot of kind ones. No one had ever been so kind to her before. But she soon learned that no one was being kind to her. They were just getting her to relax, to think of other things, so they could suddenly shoot that question at her. "What do you mean, it talked to you?" Pretty soon, it was just like mom's, or school, or any place, and she used to sit with her mouth closed and let them yell. They took her out of the hospital and put her in jail. In some ways it was good. The food, the bed was all right, too. Through the window, she could see lots of women exercising in the yard. It was explained to her that they all had much harder beds. "You are a very important young lady, you know," they told her, and that was nice at first. But as usual, it turned out they didn't mean her at all. They kept working on her. Once they brought the saucer into her, it was inside a big wooden crate with a padlock and a steel box inside that with a Yale lock. It only weighed a couple of pounds, the saucer, but by the time they got it packed, it took two men to carry it and four men with guns to watch them. They made her act out the whole thing just the way it happened, with some soldiers holding the saucer over her head. It wasn't the same. They'd cut a lot of chips and pieces out of the saucer, and besides, it was that dead gray color. They asked her if she knew anything about that, and for once, she told them. It's empty now. The only one she would ever talk to was a little man with a fat belly who said to her the first time he was alone with her, Listen, I think the way they've been treating you stinks. Now get this. I got a job to do, and my job is to find out why you won't tell what the saucer said. I don't want to know what it said. I'll never ask you. I don't even want you to tell me. Let's just find out why you are keeping it a secret. Finding out why turned out to be hours of just talking about having pneumonia and the flower pot she made in second grade that Mom threw down the fire escape and getting left back in school and the dream about holding a wine glass in both hands and peeping over it at some man. And one day she told him why she wouldn't say about the saucer, just the way it came to her. Because it was talking to me. And it's just nobody else's business. She even told him about the man crossing himself that day. It was the only other thing she had of her own. He was nice. He was the one who warned her about the trial. I have no business saying this, but they're going to give you the full dress treatment, charge and jury and all. Now, you just say what you want to say. No less, no more, you hear? And don't let them get your goat. You have a right to own something. He got up and swore and left. First, a man came and talked to her for a long time about how maybe this Earth would be attacked from outer space by beings much stronger and cleverer than we are. And maybe she had the key to a defense. So she owed it to the whole world. And then even if the Earth wasn't attacked, just think of what an advantage she might give this country over its enemies. Then he shook his finger in her face and said that what she was doing amounted to working for the enemies of her country. And he turned out to be the man that was defending her at the trial. The jury found her guilty of contempt of court, and the judge recited a long list of penalties he could give her. He gave her one of them and suspended it. They put her back in jail for a few more days, and then one fine day they turned her loose. That was wonderful at first. She got a job in a restaurant in a furnished room. She had been in the paper so much that her mother didn't want her back home. Mom was drunk most of the time, and sometimes used to tear up the whole neighborhood. But all the same, she had very special ideas about being respectable, and being in the papers all the time for spying was not her idea of being decent. So she put her maiden name on the mailbox downstairs and told her daughter not to live there anymore. At the restaurant, she met a man who asked her for a date. The first time, she spent every cent she had on a red handbag to go with her red shoes. They weren't the same shade, but anyway, they were both red. They went to the movies, and afterward, he didn't try to kiss her or anything. He just tried to find out what the flying saucer told her. She didn't say anything. She went home and cried all night. Then some men sat in the booth talking, and they shut up and glared at her every time she came past. They spoke to the boss, and he came and told her that they were electronics engineers working for the government. They were afraid to talk shop while she was around. Wasn't she some sort of spy or something? So she got fired. Sometimes she would be all right for months on end, and then someone would ask for a date. Three times out of five, she and the date were followed. Once, the man she was with arrested the man who was tailing them. Twice, the man who was tailing them arrested the man she was with. Five times out of five, the date would try to find out about the saucer. Sometimes she would go out with someone and pretend that it was a real date, but she wasn't very good at it. So she moved to the shore and got a job cleaning at night in offices and stores. There weren't many to clean, but that just meant there weren't many people to remember her face from the papers. Like clockwork, every 18 months, some feature writer would drag it all out again in a magazine or a Sunday supplement. And every time anyone saw a headlight on a mountain or a light on a weather balloon, it had to be a flying saucer. And there had to be some tired quip about the saucer wanting to tell secrets. And then for 2 or 3 weeks, she would stay off the streets in the daytime. Then she hit on the idea of the bottles. She got all the bottles she could and wrote on papers, which she corked into the bottles. She would tramp miles and miles up and down the beaches and throw the bottles out as far as she could. She knew that if the right person found one, it would give that person the only thing in the world that would help. Those bottles kept her going for 3 solid years. Everyone's got to have a secret little something to do. And at last the time came when it was no use anymore. You can go on trying to help someone who maybe exists, but soon you can't pretend there is such a person anymore. And that's it. The end. Are you cold? I asked when she was through telling me. The surf was quieter, the shadows longer.
No. Did you think I was mad at you because you saw me without my clothes?
Well, why shouldn't you be?
No, I don't care. I wouldn't have wanted you to see me even in a ball gown or overalls. You can't cover up my carcass. It shows. It's there, whatever. I just didn't want you to see me at all.
Me or anyone?
You.
Didn't the FBI try to stop you throwing those bottles?
Oh, sure. They spend I don't know how much taxpayers' money gathering them up. They still make a spot check every once in a while. They're getting tired of it, though. All the writing in the bottles is the same.
Well, so what?
All of them. Judges, jailers, jukeboxes, people. Do you know, it wouldn't have saved me a minute's trouble if I'd have told them the whole thing at the very beginning.
Really?
No, they wouldn't have believed me. What they wanted was a new weapon. Super science from a super race. To slap hell out of the super race if ever they got a chance. Or out of our own if they don't. All those brains. All that brass. They think super race, and it comes out super science. Don't they ever imagine a super race has super feelings, too? Super laughter, maybe, or super hunger? Isn't it time you asked me what the saucer said?
I'll tell you. It said, there is in certain living souls a quality of loneliness unspeakable. So great, it must be shared as company is shared by lesser beings. Such a loneliness is mine. So know by this that in immensity, there is one lonelier than you.
Dear Jesus, and how is it addressed?
It's addressed to the loneliest one.
How did you know?
It's what you put in the bottles, isn't it?
Yes. Whenever it gets to be too much, that no one cares, that no one ever did, you throw a bottle into the sea, and out goes a part of your own loneliness. You sit and think of someone somewhere finding it, learning for the first time that the worst there is can be understood.
The moon was setting, and the surf was hushed. We looked up and out to the stars.
We don't know what loneliness is like. People thought the saucer was a saucer, but it wasn't. It was a bottle with a message inside. It had a bigger ocean to cross, all of space, and not much chance of finding anybody. Loneliness? We don't know loneliness.
When I could, I asked her why she had tried to kill herself.
I've had it good with what the saucer told me. I wanted to pay back. I was bad enough to be helped. I had to know I was good enough to help. No one wants me? Fine. But don't tell me no one anywhere wants my help. I can't stand that.
I found one of your bottles 2 years ago. I've been looking for you ever since. Tide charts, current tables, maps, and just wandering. I heard some talk about you in the bottles hereabouts, and someone told me you'd quit doing it, that you'd taken to wandering the dunes at night. I knew why. I ran all the way. I got a bad foot. I think right, but the words don't come out of my mouth the way they are inside my head. I have this nose. I've never had a woman. Nobody ever wanted to hire me to work where they'd have to look at me. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. She said nothing. But it was as if a light came from her. More light and far less shadow than ever the practiced moon could cast. Among the many things it meant was that even to loneliness, there is an end for those who are lonely enough, long enough. Saucer of Loneliness, a story by Theodore Sturgeon, copyright by Galaxy Publishing Company, 1953. I'm Michael Hansen. Reading with me was Tricia Day. Technical production for this broadcast by Rich Grody. MindWebs is produced at WHA Radio in Madison.
Mallory Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Whiskey Mystery. When Gaylord Leonard called me to help authenticate a new find of his, another in his collection of pirate lore, I rushed to his house. At the entrance to his library was a cask, the kind used to store rum. It was carved with the traditional skull and crossbones and signed Bartholomew Roberts. We knew that Roberts was a notorious pirate, but both Leonard and I also knew the cask was a swindler's work of art. In a moment, I'll tell you how we knew.
Okay, one last break here, and then we'll be right back.
Of the whiskey mystery, I knew that the pirate Roberts was a teetotaler. He also wouldn't allow gambling or women on his ships, so the rum cask with his signature was a bloody fake.
Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Next up is an episode of suspense from November the 13th of 1947. Revashinka. This is based on a short story by Ray Bradbury that would also be produced by Alfred Hitchcock Presents and the Ray Bradbury Theater. The only strange thing I've been able to find so far is that the only citation for a publication date of this short story, and So Died Revashinka, claims that the story was originally published in the Saint Detective Magazine for June-July of 1953. This is strange because this escape episode is dated to 1947. I continue to look into this curiouser and curiouser.
Suspense! Tonight, starring Joseph Kearns, Loreen Tuttle, Wally Mayer, and Armina Feige, and Rio Bushinsky.
Mr. Ockham had a look about him in death as he had had in life. A general appearance which might prompt one to say, there's a man who'll one day be stabbed, or shot, or booted in the head. And although Mr. Ockham had not met his end in any of the aforementioned ways, he had been strangled, and he was dead. Dead on the floor of a theater cellar. Yes, Mr. Ockham was deceased, and nobody seemed to care. Nobody but Detective Lieutenant Krovich, who'd been sent down to have a look around. On a table he saw a small, polished bronze box with certain words on the lid which read, Rio Buchinska. Property of John Fabian, world's greatest ventriloquist. Krovich looked from the box to the three figures standing stiffly before him. They were John Fabian, ventriloquist, Alice, his wife, and Bernard Douglas, Fabian's press agent. As Krovich lit his cigar, it happened.
Please let me out. Please let me out.
The four people looked with startled eyes at the box on the table. Then Fabian, the ventriloquist, stepped forward and spoke earnestly.
No, Rhea. This is serious business, darling. You stay where you are.
Please, Ralph. You should be kind to me now after what's happened.
If you don't mind, Fabian, we'll have the dummy act at another time. Now let's get this matter clear. Each of you testify that you don't know who this dead Mr. Ockham is, yet he told the stage manager tonight that he knew Mr. Fabian and wanted to see him about something important. Oh, stop it, Fabian.
Pay no attention to her, Lieutenant.
Her? You mean you? What is this? Get together, you two.
We'll never be together again. Never again after tonight.
Give me the key to the box, Fabian.
Thank you.
Krovich stood motionless, just looking down. seeing Rhea Bushinska lying in her box and not believing what he saw. He thought, there were nights in life when you dreamed, and this is what you dreamed. There were women you saw in life, far down the street, walking, fragile, far away, unattainable. And this tiny figure was one of them. There were voices that you heard singing high in a dark church loft. Voices that made the candle flame shudder and dance to every cadence. And this was one of those voices. On a summer afternoon, you watched a spider gracefully spinning its cloudy web. And now, that web was Rhea Buchinska's evening dress, here and now. You had heard of honesty and intelligence and frankness and unafraidness all your life. And now, it looked straight up at you, fearlessly, shiningly, from a puppet's eye. She was so beautiful, your throat closed and you were sad, because you knew that she was only a puppet. John Fabian tenderly picked up Rhea Buchinska.
Oh, isn't she beautiful? She's carved from the finest wood, Rhea Buchinska is. She's appeared in London, Paris, Rome, New York. Everyone in the world knows her and loves her. Many people question Rhea Buchinska's authenticity. They think she's really alive, that she's a midget. People just cannot believe she's constructed of wood.
John Fabian's wife, Alice, stood glaring at her husband with a look of pure hatred. But he was aware of no one but the lifelike figure he held in his arms. And speaking to him, it said,
"Please don't go on about me, John. Alice doesn't like it."
"Alice has never liked anything about you, Rhea."
"No. Not here and not now, John. Tell me, Lieutenant, how did it all happen? I mean, about poor Mr. Arkham."
What is this? You'd best return to your box, Rhea Buchinska."
"But I don't want to. I have as much right to listen and talk. I'm as much a part of this murder as Alice. Or Mr. Dawkinson."
"Don't drag me into this, you little witch."
And the manner in which he replied made it obvious that Rhea Buchinska was more than an illusion to him. For he reacted to her as to a real person.
"It's just that I want the truth to be told. And if I'm locked in my bronze casket, there will be no truth. But John Fabian is a consummate liar, and I must watch him. That's right, isn't it, John?"
"Yes, I imagine it is."
"John loves me best of all the women in the world. And I love him, and try to understand his wrong way of thinking."
"We're wasting time. If you think you'll interfere with my investigation, Fabian..."
"Lieutenant, I am helpless."
"But she's in your throat."
"No. She is in my heart, which is much deeper. Sometimes I'm powerless. Sometimes she is only herself, nothing of me at all. Sometimes she tells me what to do, and I must do it. She watches over me, reprimands me, is honest where I am dishonest, ethical where I am wicked as old sin. She lives her life, I live mine. She's raised a wall in my head between herself and me, and she lives there, ignoring me if I try to make her say improper things, but cooperating if I suggest the correct words and pantomime. So, if you intend going on, I'm afraid Rhea must be present. No, locking her up will do no good."
Lieutenant Kovich sat quietly for a few moments. Then he seemed to make a decision.
All right, let us stay. Maybe before the night's over, I'll be tired enough to ask even a ventriloquist dummy questions.
For Suspense, Roma Wines are bringing you Rhea Buchinska. Roma Wines' presentation tonight in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Suspense, radio's outstanding theater of thrills, is presented by Roma Wines. That's R-O-M-A. Roma Wines, selected from the world's greatest reserves of fine wines. Some hosts have a way of making you feel completely welcome whenever you drop in for a visit. Theirs is the kind of hospitality that says, "Come in and make yourself at home." Well, such is the hospitality of millions of Americans who always keep Roma California wines on hand. For Roma wines lend sparkle and companionship to any occasion. And there's a Roma wine to please every taste. For friendly entertaining, serve nut-like golden amber Roma sherry, rich red Roma port, or mellow flame-bright Roma muscatel. You'll find that these better-tasting Roma wines add warmth and charm to any get-together, brighten those restful stay-at-home evenings with your family. Tomorrow, solve your problem of what to serve when friends drop in with Roma Wines. That's R-O-M-A. Roma Wines, America's largest selling wines.
And now Roma Wines bring back to our Hollywood soundstage Ermina Feige as narrator, Joseph Kearns as Fabian the ventriloquist, and Wally Mayer as Detective Krovich in Rhea Bushinska, a play well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Once more, Mr. Douglas, do you recognize the dead man?
No. He looks somewhat familiar. An actor type, I believe.
One of you three is lying. From the condition of Occam's shoes, his worn clothing, he needed money. Are you in love with Mrs. Fabian?
Why, I...
Really, Lieutenant?
I've been watching you, your actions.
My actions?
Yes, yes. The way you look at Rio Buchinska's box. The way you hold your breath when she appears. The way you knot your fingers when she talks. The way you stare at her.
If you think for one moment that I'm jealous of a little piece of wood...
Aren't you?
No, I'm not jealous of her.
You needn't tell him, Alice.
Let her.
They all stared at the figurine, even Fabian the ventriloquist, as if her cry had come from an alien throat.
Alice, tell him. I married John 7 years ago. He said he loved me. I loved him and I loved Rhea Buchinska too, at first anyway. But then I began to see that he really paid more attention to her than he did to me. I began to feel hatred, not for Rhea Buchinska because it wasn't her fault, but I felt a terrible hatred for John, because I knew it was all his fault. His cleverness, his sadistic temperament. Each jealousy on my part was a tribute to the perfection of his art. She came out of him like a woman out of a dark god. But I don't hate Rhea. She's lovely, sweet and honest. Everything that John isn't. Tell about Mr. Douglas.
When I got no understanding, no love from John, I turned to Mr. Douglas.
Uh-huh. The dead man was a blackmailer. He came to the theater tonight to see a husband about you. You killed him to prevent that interview.
I didn't kill him.
Douglas might have and not told you.
Why kill a man? John knew all about it.
I did indeed.
The next day, Lieutenant Krovich was back.
Yes, come in.
Fabian, I have something here which might interest you.
With a tight grin in his face, Lieutenant Krovich held out the photograph of a woman. Fabian stared at the shiny picture before him, and then he fell back in his chair. He shut his eyes as if with a great ache in his head. Krovich turned the picture over carefully and began to read from the typewritten data on the back.
Name, Ilya Riemansk. Weight, 100 pounds, blue eyes, black hair, oval face. Born 1914, New York City. Disappeared 1934. Believed a victim of amnesia, of Russian Slav parentage.
Oh, no.
You know, Fabian, it was pretty silly to go through the files for a picture of a ventriloquist dummy. They all laughed at headquarters. And yet, here she is, Rhea Buchinska. Not papier-mâché, not wood, not a puppet. But a woman who once lived and moved about and disappeared. Take it from there, Fabian.
Well, Lieutenant, there's nothing to it. I saw her picture long ago. Liked her looks and copied my puppet after her.
Nothing to it, huh? Listen, Fabian, this morning I went through a stack of Billboard magazines that high. In the year 1934, I found an interesting article concerning an act playing the smaller circuits, known as Fabian and Sweet William. Sweet William was a little male dummy. As usual in such acts, there was a girl assistant, Ilya Riemansk. Look at that picture. The resemblance between the real woman on one hand and Rhea Buchinska, the puppet, on the other, is startling.
She was my assistant, but that was all. I simply used her as a model.
It all starts and ends with Rhea Buchinska. Why should you love a puppet so intensely? Because you love the original woman intensely.
All right, all right. In 1934, I was billed as Fabian and Sweet William. Sweet William was a small, bald-nosed little boy dummy I carved years ago. I was playing Los Angeles when this girl, Ilya Riemansk, appeared at the stage door one night. She wanted a job. I remember. It was autumn.
John Fabian remembered Ilya Riemansk in the half-light at the stage alley. He remembered how startled he was at her fresh beauty, her eagerness. The way the rain, when it came down through the narrow alley, caught in her dark hair and touched her feverish cheeks. She became his assistant, worked in the act. And in 4 short months, he, who had always denied and scoffed at love, became hopelessly loved with this woman. Then there were arguments, and things much more than arguments. Things done and said that were violent and unfair. He wanted her to marry him. She never quite accepted. He went into hysterical rages at her. Once he destroyed her wardrobe. That much she had taken. But it was somewhat different on that last night when he had shouted at her, taken hold of her, and slapped her brutally 3 times across the face.
And Ilya Riemansk vanished that night. Vanished. The police questioned me. There was talk of murder. But she was gone with no trace. A record of her was sent to all the larger cities. That was the end of it for the police. But not for me. The knowledge of her going was too much. She might be dead or just run away, but wherever she was, I knew I needed her. One night I returned home more depressed than usual. I collapsed on a chair. And before I knew it, I found myself speaking to Sweet William in the totally dark room. William, William. Oh, this is all over and done. I can't go on.
Coward. You can get her back if you want.
No, I can't. No, I can never get her back.
Yes, yes, you can. Think. Think of a way to get her back. Think of a way. Come on. You can do it. Put me away. Start all over.
Start all over?
Yes. Begin carving. Exactly. And slowly and lovingly. Carving. Make the little arching nostrils just so. And cut her black thin eyebrows round and high. And make her cheeks in small duplicate hollows. And...
No. It's monstrous. I can never do it.
Yes, yes, you could. Yes, you could. Could.
And the voice faded away like a water ripple in a dark cave. Blackness rushed over Fabian. His head fell forward. He whimpered. And Sweet William sighed. And then they both lay silent and solemnly unconscious. The next morning, John Fabian purchased the best grain piece of wood he could buy. But when he reached home, despair seized him. How could he fashion his warm Ilya from this cold wood? How could he shape this dumb block of dead substance into anything faintly approximating her glowing light?
Go on, go on!
It was Sweet William who egged him on.
You can do it!
And for 20 weeks he worked. He carved her hands into things as natural and beautiful as shells lying in the sun. Then Sweet William lay dust-cloaked in his box, from time to time feebly croaking some sarcasm, some criticism, some hint, some help. But he was done, soon to be untouched, inanimate wood. As weeks passed and Fabian molded and scraped and polished the new wood, Sweet William lay longer and longer in stricken silence. And one day, as Fabian held the puppet in his hand, Sweet William seemed to look at him a moment with puzzled eyes. And then there was a death rattle in his throat.
No,
And sweet William was gone. And now, as Fabian carved, a fluttering, an attempting of speech in his throat began echoing, re-echoing the sounds of Ilya Ryamansk. At the year's ending, he was thinned and without money. But by then he had searched his stream of consciousness, experimented, and given the doll all the gracious mannerisms and shy gestures of the real woman. And then, at last, he held Ilya Ryamansk in his arms again. They were together. He could talk to her and she could reply. And the first thing he made the little creature say was,
I love you, John Fabian.
Oh, Rhea.
I see. And your wife?
Alice. She was another of my assistants. She did her work well. She loved me. I don't know why I married her.
I see. What about the dead man, Arkham?
I'd never seen him before until you showed me his body in the cellar.
That's not true. Don't lie, John Fabian.
Fabian's cheeks strained white and the bones jutted out tensely. The puppet spoke, looking straight at Krovich.
John received the first blackmail letter a month ago. It said simply, Ryabushinska, born 1914, died 1934. Born again in 1930.
Fabian seemed paralyzed, unable to answer. He had a trapped, helpless, insane expression. His lips trembled. He searched the room as if seeking some way out where a frustration and a truth did not wait to bar his way.
Arkham threatened to expose me to the world.
Go on.
I wanted my love for Ilya kept to myself. What sort of a love would it be in the future if people really guessed the significance of my carving this figurine that talked and moved? People would laugh or be disgusted. Perverted, criminal mind, they'd shout. Ugly, horrible, revolting. And how could I play my love scenes with Rhea anymore when they knew? Not when with every word I uttered, someone in the audience would nudge someone else and whisper, she lived once, you know, but disappeared. They say he killed her. They say he loved her.
How much did Arkham want?
$1,000 to start with. And more later.
And so you killed him?
No, I didn't kill Arkham, Lieutenant. I paid him $1,000.
We found no money on him.
Nevertheless, I paid him. Alice and Douglas must have heard our conversation. They've wanted to be rid of me for years now. I'm not blind. Alice saw a way of ridding herself of me and getting some money, too. Why, she's nothing but a...
Just a moment. It's something I wish to say. And yet I can't say it.
Krovich turned. He saw John Fabian's eyes widen in his head, as if a terrible conflict were raging, fighting within. His throat convulsed again and again, and lines cut deep in his cheeks, and the hollows of his face sank in.
I was in the room when Mr. Arkham came.
No, no, Rhea.
I lay in my bunk, and I listened, and I heard. And I know.
No.
Mr. Arkham threatened to destroy me. Tear me up. Burn me into ashes. If John didn't pay him $1,000.
Then suddenly,
there came a falling sound. Mr. Arkham's head must have struck the floor. I heard Mr. Fabian cry out, swearing and sobbing all in one. I heard a hissing, gasping, choking, horrible...
You heard nothing. You're deaf and dumb and blind and lifeless. You heard nothing. Your ears are calm.
But they hear. And then the hissing, choking sound stopped. I heard John drag Mr. Arkham to the door, open it, and take Mr. Arkham down the stairs, under the theater, toward the old dressing room that hadn't been used in years. Down!
It was a scene so incongruous, so impossible, so completely beyond the veil of sanity and reason that Krovich recoiled even as he watched. If ever in the time of the world the forces that manipulate man struggled one side against the other, this was the time. The shocked, pallid face of John Fabian wrenching,
the horrible protrusion of the eyes, the clenching of the teeth as a censor, then relaxing again, the subtle move of the throat, and the high, sad, and accusative voice of Rhea Buchinska leaping from her tiny, shining lips. Fabian must have known what was happening, and yet he did not know.
I'm not made to live this way. There's nothing for us now, anyway. Of course, the world will know of us. Even when you killed him and I lay in my bronze box last night, I realized, we both realized that these were our last hours. Because while I've accepted your weaknesses and lies, I can't exist in murder. It couldn't have gone on. No one can live side by side with such knowledge.
Fabian took her in his arms and held her high into the warm sunlight. She looked down at him with her clear, honest way of seeing him. There were angry, helpless tears in his eyes. His hand shook, and in shaking made her tremble too. Her mouth closed and open, silent, gaping and shutting again and again with no words. Fabian began to sob. He closed his fingers unbelievingly around his own throat. His eyes numbed. He looked like a man trying to remember something beautiful. Her voice. How it sounded. How to make it sound again. How to make her take back all she said that was the truth.
No. She's gone. She's gone. And I can't find her. I try, but I can't find her. She's run off behind the dark wall. And so deep down and far away in the night, I'll never be able to find her again. Yes, she's gone.
Rhea Buchinska slipped bonelessly from his limp hand, folded over and glided noiselessly down to lie upon the cold, dirty floor. Her eyes closed, her mouth gently sealed. Fabian didn't even look at her as Krovich led him away.
Suspense! And so closes Rhea Buchinska, starring Armana Faguet as narrator, Joseph Kearns as Fabian, Wally Mayer as Krovich, and Lorene Tuttle as Rhea. Tonight's study in suspense, presented by Roma Wines. That's R-O-M-A. Roma Wines, America's largest selling wines. Yes, more Americans do enjoy Roma wines than any other wines. And this is Truman Bradley to tell you why. It's because Roma wines taste better. You see, Roma selects and presses only the choicest California grapes. Then, with ancient skills and unmatched winemaking resources, Roma master vintners guide this luscious grape treasure unhurriedly to tempting perfection. These finer Roma wines are placed with other mellow Roma wines to await later selection for your enjoyment from the world's greatest reserves of fine wines. This weekend, give your family and friends a surprise. Serve delicious Roma California Sherry. Roma Sherry is a glorious golden amber wine, soft and mellow on the tongue, with a delightful nut-like taste that's a perfect invitation to dining pleasure. And remember to insist on Roma. That's R-O-M-A, Roma Sherry, because more Americans enjoy Roma wines than any other wines.
Tonight's suspense radio play was by Mel Donnelly from a short story by Ray Bradbury. Be sure to listen next Thursday, same time, to Suspense. Produced and directed by William Spear for the Roma Wine Company of Fresno, California.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the Internet, and there's a good deal of ancillary material there. More details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.